I want to mention that Alan Franzlubers was a major contributor to the organization of this symposium. Dr. Grace is what is your affiliation? It's University of Queensland at Queensland University of Technology. Right state, wrong university. So welcome and.
Thanks, Diane. Well, first time of a group of these people, and also first on the first speaker, so that's a thanks very much. Phil Robertson and Klaus Butterback-Bahl are the co-authors. We've been working together for the last few years trying to take forward this whole issue of greenhouse gas emissions in agriculture, and mostly look after the methodological problems that we face. Basically, I just want to talk about the policy environment we're in at the moment, and then I'll go through some of these methodological issues, talk about some results that we've found, and some conclusions on the talk. I think globally we're in this policy environment of intensified agriculture, whether it's the developed world or the developing world. We've got to create more food on less land. We've got degraded lands. We have static in terms of nitrogen use efficiency. That's pretty generalised. Some regions might be better than others, but generally where there's an overuse of nitrogen. We have static or low levels of soil organic carbon, soil organic matter, which we need to accommodate and take into account. But we've also got this idea now that soil carbon storage and greenhouse gas offsets are the way of the future in terms of greenhouse gas mitigation and to reduce global warming. So we've got this potential win-win, but on the other hand, we've also got to produce crops and we've also got to have farmers in all countries walking away with money in their pocket and be sustainable. One of the initiatives that has just been created, the Global Research Alliance, has a number of countries that wish to do this. And there's various investments around, but there are some countries, and this is coincidental, but the Australian government has just passed a carbon tax, which is good or bad, and they've just thrown $429 million into research and extension and education in carbon offsets and greenhouse gas emissions. Now, for a country our size, that's a lot of money. And I coordinate one of those programs, and that's what I'll talk a bit about today, but I'll provide Australian examples, but I want you to try and look at your own country and see how you potentially could do the same thing, because we've gone down a pathway with a number of international groups, and this is the way we've sort of decided to best to handle looking at greenhouse gas offsets. Another issue I just want to touch on is how do we sell this to growers? Because in the end, whilst we're scientists and doing research, we actually have to get producers to take up these practices. So we don't try and sell greenhouse gas emissions per se to a grower. We try and tell them it's sustainable agriculture. And greenhouse gases are a good indicator of inefficiencies in your system. Nitrous oxide, you may have too much nitrogen there at any time when an event happens. Low carbon, low CO2 usually means you've run your system down. And methane will come off normally where you have waterlogging for an excessive amount of time. So you've got soil constraints there. So when the grower can recognise that, you're getting the real win-win. He's getting productivity gains and you're also getting greenhouse gas offsets. And this is key to where we go in the future. So to talk about what we've done and what others have done worldwide, most countries would have gone down this route to start off with. The chamber system, there are hundreds probably of different chambers built all the world over, manual sampling. You come in, you take a number of samples over a period of time and you put it through a gas chromatograph in the field. They're in various sizes, shapes. This one's got a fan in it, covering crops. But the biggest problem in all of this is accessibility. When you get a denitrification event, how do you get in there? How do you measure when that happens? And I know there are a lot of different ways to do it. If labour's relatively cheap, and we've done this in Mexico, we've put planks across, we've been able to get in at any time, but you've got to set these things up and you've got to have people out there to do the work. So one way to get around this has been some work that Klaus Butterback Bahl originally put together through his a German group, building these automated systems. And I know there's a number of different groups in the world who are now moving down this route, but what I'd like to just dwell on here for a little while is just the power of using these systems. This is actually a cotton system, and we've got them in the furrows and also on the rows. This clay soil, a few of you may know a guy called Keith Weir, or read about a guy called Keith Weir, who's done a lot of work in nitrous oxide. Keith Weir tried to get in here to do manual sampling and sunk to his hips. And there was no one else there, and he sat there for 2 hours thinking he was going to die there over the weekend. So he was very happy when we brought these new chambers in. These chambers are relatively portable. They can be mass-produced just about anywhere now. And in this is one of the older sets, but basically there are two boxes. Now it's basically refined to one where you've got a Lycor, you've got a GC, you've got your whole sampling system in one box. So you can just throw it around, very robust. Various students and postdocs I've had have banned me from putting anything like that now because they had to crawl in it and they didn't like it at all. They wanted something bigger. But you can basically do it like this and set it up in 3 hours. So why should you go down this route? What's the advantage of just of accessibility? There must be something else. Dave Rowlings, a postdoc, did some earlier work. We wanted to really pull this apart and say, what is the value of doing this other than the accessibility issue? This is looking at a number of different land uses, rainforest, pasture, and a tree crop adjacent to each other. And we've actually measured for 2 years with these automated systems every day. And we've come up with a annual mean, and there it is there, 516 in the rainforest, about 1.8 kilos in the pasture, and about 1.7 in the lychee. Then we disaggregated the data to see if I'd gone and sampled on a 2-day interval or a 3-day interval or a 7-day interval, which is what a lot of people do. A 2-day interval, you can see, and this is every single combination we could pull out of this 2 years of data. So you can see a bit of a range starting to come up now because we're sampling every second day, not every day. But now I've changed this to the deviation from the daily estimate to make it a bit easier for you to interpret. If you sample every 2 to 3 days, things are now starting to widen. If you look at the pasture system where you do have relatively high emissions, similar to a crop, you're getting a minimum and maximum value compared to the real mean, 10 to 16% difference. If you move out to a sampling frequency of a week, which a lot of people do, you really start to blow things apart. How you can see your estimates are out by plus or minus 30%. Now, if you're trying to do real, absolute accounting in terms of inventories, you really need numbers that are on the money. And it's quite obvious from this data and other data sets that we've subsequently collected that the power of using the automated system and the value and the cost far outweighs having the other systems, the more manual systems. But there is a role for them, and I'll show you that shortly. If you blow this out to 14 or 30 days, which people don't normally do, and sample, say, once a month, you can see the errors come up to 200% nearly, but people wouldn't be doing that. What we haven't done here, though, is looked at the event-based sampling, which is critical as well. Event-based sampling, again, though, you've still got to get in there. If you do it on a weekly basis, and that's what a lot of people do, the errors are quite large. The other aspect to look at is the diurnal variation. With the automated systems, you can get 8 to 9 cycles in a day. They're totally automated. There's 12 chambers. You can do, say, 3 replicates of 4 treatments, something like that. But you can just see here, if you'd just gone in and sampled around the noon hour, you can see the deviation from the daily mean from all the fluxes. Or if you've gone in the afternoon, you've got a very large deviation when you come to the pasture and lychee situations. Again, it's this diurnality. This is a cotton data set, which really displays it very nicely. You can see this is on a 24-hour cycle, and over different irrigation, which you don't have to take too much into account. The N2O flux rates are on the left, and in this case here, they fit exactly about a four-hour shift from the maximum of the day. So in one way, you could use this data if you were prepared to go out with manual chambers and measure on a diurnal frequency over a period of time. You could determine when is the best time of the day to sample to get your average emission. But at least in this way, you get eight fluxes in a day and you get the real, a very tight mean that you can use for, in our case, we use it for simulations. Now, this moves on. For some reason it's jammed. Okay. So what? Where do we take this? Using it in a network has been the best way forward, and there's been some investments prior in Australia and other countries, including the US. We've developed this nitrous oxide research program. The chambers are actually used for validating models. Sorry, we'll go back, for calibrating models. And we use a variety of models, but at least you've got very high resolution, good information to do the calibration. Then we have this satellite network of low frequency temporal manual chamber sites. In Australia, it's called the National Adaptation and Mitigation Initiative, and what we're doing there is getting greater geographic coverage so we can validate the models. So we've done the calibration on a very tight data set, a very high resolution data set, and then we've gone in to validate that on a greater geographical coverage. Combining with that are some laboratory and process studies, and these are critical in terms of looking at inhibitors, and this data also feeds into the calibration of the models. And then we have the modelling itself. For some reason, I think this mouse has died, but I'll just use this. Now, just to reflect how we've set this network up, some of you may be aware of where Australia is, and you may have been there as well, but the nature of this talk is looking at both tropical and temperate systems. What this is, there's about 18 to 20 million hectares of grains grown in Australia. And basically, the tropics start, I haven't got a pointer, but if you just split the country in half, the tropics are basically the northern part. We've got three zones. We've got the western region, which is mostly sandy, coarse-textured soils, where you have a pretty consistent yield around 2.5 tonnes. You've got your southern region, and these are Mediterranean regions through here, which is the yellow area, and that's higher rainfall zone near the coast. And then you've got, moving into the subtropics and tropics, you've got the green area. And you've got a flip in terms of what the climate's doing. It's not Mediterranean, obviously. You've gone into the tropics, so you've got summer rainfall. We've set this system up. We've got six main sites throughout the country, looking at mostly in rain-fed grains, some irrigated systems. Most of this actually started from irrigated agriculture. People thinking, obviously, heavy textured soils, a lot of nitrogen, a lot of water, what's going to happen? A lot of emissions. And actually, that's sort of probably the crux of the talk I'm trying to get across today. Carbon management drives N2O emissions. You can have everything else set up in place. You can have the perfect storm. If you haven't got carbon to drive denitrification, it's not going to happen. And this is the differentiation we've found between rotations and management systems, that it's the way that carbon has been managed in those systems. And what I would like to do over the next few minutes is actually go through a number of these systems to show you the results. This is just one of the systems we have in northern New South Wales. It's like a 600 millimetre rainfall. This is a luxury system. You've actually got a shed you can live in and do anything you like in there. So this is the high end. And this is another system we've got in place. But again, they're all pretty similar and they're low cost. Again, this is a residue retain system. There's a bit of heating problem sometimes. Some of these have got perspex, whatever. In this case, there's a tea cosy sort of thing they call on top to keep the temperature down. But again, very similar, and there's the system itself, and just a few examples of our systems. And a lot of the information is available online for people to use for modelling. Now, that's the global community is allowed to use this, provided they contact the researchers and get permissions to work with them. So just to go through briefly this, to sort of push the point in terms of carbon management and how critical it is, because we're moving into a situation now where farmers are going to potentially be paid worldwide to store carbon in soils. It's going to work in some. We know it's going to be a tough ask in others in terms of sequestration, but it's going to have a major effect in nitrogen losses on some as well. If you look at this rain-fed grain system in the west of the country, it's coarse textured soils, deep profiles. These are areas where, if you use the IPCC default, you'd still be using a 1% loss. In this case, the loss for the whole year is 50 grams of nitrogen per hectare, and the efficiency factor is about actually 0.02%. Now, this information is critical in terms of, as I said, carbon management. There is carbon flowing through there, but at a minuscule amount, and you do not get the water conditions to get a denitrification event. This is basically nitrification happening in these sort of situations. To show the extreme, I want to show a rain-fed grains area, high rainfall, about 700, well, high rainfall, 700 millimetres. That's not high rainfall in some areas. But this is a system that's been under long-term pasture. Okay, you've got, you will have certain people who will be going in and out of pasture systems. Animals are not actually cost-effective in a lot of economies at the moment, but there's a lot of people in this southern part of the world that are actually moving from pastures into crops. Now, there is no nitrogen added at all to this system, and this is a wheat crop. I want you to look on the left-hand side at the flux in kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per day, and when the water is up, which is the top purple line, you can see the flux gets up to 1 kilo of N2O. Now, if you use N2O as an indicator of what is being lost in terms of total N and N2, we've measured numbers that are 30 to 70 times in excess of the N2O. So potentially this system, it's a cropping system. It's classified as a cropping system if you use the IPCC inventory. Nothing's been added, but in 1 year, 35 kilograms of nitrogen has gone off as N2O. So one, how do you account for that? And that's just a carbon, this is a carbon-rich system. Now, and when I say carbon-rich, it doesn't mean just the total organic carbon value. We've got low organic carbon systems, which are cycling a lot of carbon through residue retention or soluble additions through, say, cane systems, which are very large in emissions. I'll move up to this rain-fed system, which is sort of on the cusp of the Mediterranean systems and the subtropical tropical systems. This is a canola chickpea system where we actually wanted to, instead of just looking at different N rates and different management tillage systems, we wanted to look at the farming system in its entirety. We wanted to look at what a farmer would actually be doing or a grower would be actually doing in terms of crop sequencing. And in this case, looking at various nitrogen inputs from either chickpea, and then they'll have a fallow during the dry periods and then go into wheat with or without nitrogen. So these are realistic rotations. There's a fair bit of information here, I apologise, but just all the spikes, this is the accumulated N2O over time, and in total, the scale on the left-hand side, the top number, which is very small, again, I apologise, is 1,400 grams, and that's 1.4 kilos. So this is over a year and a half or a bit more. So compare that to what I last showed you, 35 kilos. But again, all the spikes in N2O were coincident with rainfall events in every case. So the efficiency factors in this case, about 0.5-0.8%, and in the chickpea, we were counting the chickpea as a nitrogen input, it was about 0.3. Again, it's all very exact data based on these automatic systems, which have made our modelling much more precise. Where this all started was actually in these irrigated cotton systems, and I showed you a picture earlier on of that in the heavy clay soils. Again, left-hand side, I keep saying that because all the different relative magnitudes of these emissions is important to take into account, and it all relates back to carbon. In this system, an irrigated wheat cotton system, they strip every bit of carbon out. The cotton is taken off and there's not much left anyway except a few sticks. And in this case, in the wheat, they strip all the residue off. Emissions are very low. Again, over a, this is a 12-month, 18-month period, 1.8 kilograms of nitrogen has been emitted over time. There is an irrigation effect, which is significant. Basically adding 50 kgs of N, different irrigation amounts, and you can differentiate very clearly what the impact of irrigation is, but it pales into insignificance when you consider the whole idea of carbon management. Another issue when it comes to looking at what governments require and what a farmer would require is the emission factor. The emission factor there under full irrigation is about 0.4% of the nitrogen added, and in the dry land it's about 2.2%. Obviously, from a inventory point of view, the government would like you to be doing the dry land and not irrigating at all. But from a farmer's point of view, he wants to walk away with a decent yield in his truck. And in this case, if you look at kilograms of N2ON per tonne of yield, the full irrigated system was the better. So how do you come to a happy medium there that you still have growers maintaining an income, but they're also not emitting to the extent that the government will intervene? The last one I want to show is this rain-fed sugarcane site. This is slightly an anomaly, but on the other hand, a lot of the cane grown in our country and in other countries is on acid sulphate soils. And this is another factor that needs to be taken into account. Again, pretty tight sort of slide in terms of the information. But again, look at the side. The amount of N that's being, this is the N2O fluxes on the top, you can see they are about half a kilo of nitrogen per hectare per day under a major event. The cumulative loss over, in this case, about a year and a half has been 30 kilos of nitrogen. Again, the emission factor here is about, I think, about 10%. Now, the IPCC recommends 1%. Acid sulphate soil, we need to take that into account. Also, in this case, we've got soybean coming in here to act as obviously a nitrogen substitute, but it's actually pushed the emissions up higher because of that extra carbon that it's actually adding in this system. Methane is a big problem in flooded sugarcane as well, and I know we chase it in rice, but in this case, the amount of methane emitted from these sites is equivalent in terms of its global warming potential to nitrous oxide. So that's another area people don't really chase in terms of sugarcane and the rice N2O combination. This is just some other work. I mentioned the lab work. DMPP is the trade name, I think, in Australia is NTEC. And the work by Deli Chen and co on this has been fantastic in terms of getting us forward a 73% reduction. So what the government is now trying to do is develop methodologies that are practical. We don't know in terms of money how practical or cost how practical it is, but to move forward, and it's this sort of data which is critical in terms of making these decisions. Subsequent to starting this program 3 years ago, we've rolled out a number of other chamber sites. This is just the latest one with CSIRO. This is on a set of lysimeters. They actually built the chambers. We weren't going to get involved in building something so intricate as that. But we actually built the sampling unit that went with it. But this is just the latest one off the press. And with Phil Robertson and Klaus Butterback-Bahl, who originally started this, Phil Robertson's got a number of these systems in place already, looking at bioenergy and also looking at different N rates with Neville Miller. So where we are on this, it's just so I can finish off, this whole idea of carbon management, we're moving from this probably carbon-limited situation, the blue line, to a red situation, this exponential response in N rates. The IPCC line is linear, as we know, but where you've got a system which is transiting in terms of carbon management, if this is what happens, N2O emissions are going to be totally different to what you would expect. So in our case, what we've tried to do, at this, just as a first cut, we've tried to come up, and I know in Canada there's some similar things going on, but we've basically tried to eliminate where N2O is a problem in this area of Australia or throughout Australia. If someone comes to us with a methodology or to the government and says, we want to do an N2O mitigation methodology and gain some credits, they'll look at this map first to make a decision whether it's actually the way to go. The next step is to refine this map, and that's what this carbon farming initiative over the next 6 years will work at. So my conclusions are the automated systems are worth it for the accessibility and the accuracy that you can gain. There's a clear distinction between carbon limited and carbon available cropping systems, and that is why I've talked about rotations and different management practices. It's different everywhere the world over, but it's the carbon that's cycling through those systems that has a main impact. Management history has a big impact. You saw those pasture sites where you've gone into crop. 35 kilos of N, how do you account for that? And that's N2O, so we don't know what's happened with the N2 yet. And that's another conclusion I should have added there. This N2O, N2 ratio is a big area we need to get into. That's something that's really lacking. I've mentioned soil chemistry only because in this case, at the cane systems, the acid sulfate are drivers. Acid sulfate soils need to be looked at as specific examples, but we need to look at these generally all over the world. There are different chemical sort of makeups of some soils that need to be taken into account. An increased emphasis on carbon farming will potentially increase N2O emissions. So many years ago, I know many people were just talking about looking at soil carbon and predicting where it was going and what management practices you had. I know it's changed, but I think the data we're collecting is making it much more bright in terms of what goes off in people's heads now in terms of, hey, I know what I need to look for. We've got to improve nitrogen use efficiency, whether it's inhibitors, variable rate technology. We've definitely got to move that way worldwide. And simulation is really one of the only ways we're going to move this. I know there's pros and cons for it, but with some good data, practical models, and there's a good community out there, we can make some big changes. Just to acknowledge all the people who've been involved in this nitrous oxide research program, some of them actually here today. This is a big effort, and thanks very much. Thanks. Yes. That was just soil cores that were being incubated in that case. But there has been work done on a number of... Deli Chen actually can answer that because he did the work. Yeah. It will in certain places, obviously. I mean, where in that case, that map is basically a texture map. Where you've got coarse textured soils, nothing's going to happen. But that's what it's basically around where you can store carbon and high texture. Exactly. In fact,
I still believe the world is more critical.
Yeah.
Because you look at the cellist emission data, the reason is for the huge internal emission, when that's going to happen from saturation,
yes,
to dry. Or in a one study, you see a huge internal emission when the water is drained.
Mm.
We did some monitoring of nitrous oxide emission of different organic soils. Some of them had also sulfate, high sulfate in the water. We saw extreme rates.
Yeah. That there usually is, exactly. That's a good point. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. haven't done, that's one area. Now with this carbon farming push, there's a push for perennial grasses. There hasn't been any work done in perennials in that case. I haven't seen any data. There is obviously some out there, but you're right. There is some on, as I showed there, on chickpeas, the annual crop, and the emissions were lower, but on the other hand, unfortunately, there's nothing. I haven't got anything from perennials, but that's a very good point in terms of carbon storage and where people are moving. It is. It's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if it's a threshold. I think it's more what's cycling through that system and how active that system is in terms of turning carbon over. I think for a long time people have been looking for thresholds where they'll have the healthiest soil or where things are going to change. I think it's different in a lot of... It varies. I think the bottom line is you've got to have a system where you have significant inputs and they're being balanced. The outputs are being balanced by your inputs, and that's your threshold.